This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Today we're going to be talking about trauma. In particular, we're going to talk about trauma systems. We'll learn about what that is, how well we're doing that in Alaska, what's unique about Alaska, what we need to do to improve it. For those of you who think we have a trauma system, you may want to listen. We may not have as much as you think we do, but we'll let you decide whether you think we need to push a little harder for that by the end of the day as well. Before we get into that, I want to kind of put trauma and unintentional injury, let's broaden the definition a little bit, into a little bit more perspective. And to do that, I'm going to take a recent press release from the Center for Disease Control. First, some good news. The U.S. life expectancy has reached just about 78 degrees. It's 78 years. It's continued to increase, and it has increased by 1.4 years from 1997 to 2007. So in the last 10 years, we have steadily increased our life expectancy. Those for males and females have both increased. The life expectancy is a record high for males now at 75.3 years, and for women, 80.4. And that gap has now narrowed to 5 years from a previous peak of about 7.8 years around 1980. The gap obviously can be decreasing because women are now dying at a younger age, or men are living longer, or a combination of those two things. And I don't know exactly the reason why it's narrowing, but that's the possibilities for you. Heart disease and cancer are the two leading causes of death. However, they're really bulked into the end of the age life expectrum after about 45 years of age. And from the first year of life up until 44 years of age, unintentional injuries in this country are the leading cause of death. And for quite a long time, since I think the at least mid-80s, that's been true, particularly in children, as infectious diseases have become less and less of an issue, partly because of lifestyle changes, education, immunization, antibiotics, and so forth. What about injuries and traumatic injuries in particular? They're estimated to be responsible for about 160,000 deaths each year. Children account for about 25% of all traumatic injuries. So for all U.S. Residents, unintentional injury currently ranks about fifth. It's a little higher than that in Anchorage, I think, or in Alaska, and we'll hear about that shortly. In the studio today with me is Frank Sacco. Frank is the trauma director at the Alaska Native Medical Center, and he's also chair of the Alaska Trauma Systems. Joining me by phone from Lincoln, Nebraska, is Reginald Burton. He is chief reviewer for the American College of Surgeons, and in November 2008 was part of a team that surveyed the trauma systems in Alaska and gave a report, which we'll be referring to on this program. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us back in Lincoln as well. And you were saying before this started, there was a significant traumatic trauma going on down there in Lincoln as well. A bus got hit by a semi, huh?
Yeah, school bus hit by a semi. 23 injuries. But like I said, the system all went real well. We've had a system here for quite some time, and we've been a designated trauma center for 20 years. So it's those kind of things that sort of play out as what a real trauma system is.
We've talked about trauma already, and perhaps we might want to discuss what kinds of things lead to trauma most commonly, but I also want to quickly get to what is a trauma system. But let's start with what we're meaning by trauma exactly, and what are the causes, particularly as it is in Alaska. But I don't mind talking about how we compare to the United States, the rest of the U.S. on this too. Frank, you want to handle this one?
Sure. You know, when we're talking about trauma, We're basically talking about any bodily injury that's kind of caused from an external force. It could be from a car accident. It could be from a gunshot wound. You know, there's a broad spectrum of things when we refer to trauma. You know, we tend to think of trauma as an accident. And I think that sort of thinking has kind of led us to approach trauma differently than we have other diseases. And what we find is, just like other diseases, that if you approach it in a public health paradigm, that looking at injury prevention, looking at root causes of trauma, knowing that it's predictable, having acute care systems that are tied together, then taking care of patients after they've been injured, that we're going to have the best outcomes. I think an analogy would be with cardiac care. We know that there are risk factors for cardiac disease, including diet and hypertension. And so we need to work on those and reducing those risk factors and preventing the disease. But even with all that, we're going to have people that have heart disease. And we want to have a system so that if you're having a heart attack, that everybody from the bystander that sees you having the heart attack, who knows what to do, to the pre-hospital folks that are going to do the right thing and get you the place where you can get treated, that's how we're going to get the best outcomes. And a lot of those changes in cardiac care, a lot of those changes in infectious disease have resulted in some of the improvements that you kind of referred to at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Burton, then a system refers to this whole conglomeration of individuals and personnel and equipment in getting the right person to the right place at the right time. Is that sum
it
up?
Yeah, that's correct. I think basically the system, the word system, really sort of sums up what works the best. Starts basically from identifying the population you're talking about. You know, the trauma, like I said, Dr. Sacco said, the trauma patient is basically injured, that can be stabbed, crushed, hit by a car, fell from a roof, any injury. So you know who the patients are, and then you need a whole system set up so that everybody knows what to do. You know, starting with state legislation, figuring out what the problem is, what kind of legislation needs to be enacted so that you have systems that can look at that, act to it, decrease that rate of injury and injury prevention, and also once the injury does occur, that you have set up a whole system of care, starting from the pre-hospital provider, training them to know what to do with the trauma, the injured patient, to the systems of transport. How do you get them from one level to another if they need more care? How do you verify that the hospitals that are going to be taking care of trauma patients are doing a good job? And that's sort of what the American College of Surgeons does, is we don't designate, that's a legal issue, but we do verify. They come in and look at the systems and say, yes, they provide this level of care. But that's also very important, because hospitals are just like people, and we tend to think this is okay and that's okay, and we get lax on different areas. And to have a standard system where you grade everybody by and you keep yourself sharp is also very important. And then the system of care only works if you have a performance improvement or quality improvement assurance, or however you want to, whatever terminology you want to use. They say basically what makes a trauma center out of a hospital is that they have a performance improvement program that looks at everything that deals with those injured patients, from did everybody respond, were there complications, did everybody have what they needed to do the jobs to take care of this injured patient, were the right people available, consultants available, equipment available. So the performance improvement piece is a huge piece of being a trauma center. But you put all that together, and you have the whole system, working for the injured patient and watching the injured patient, and are we getting better with prevention? Are we getting better with the care? And that's what has been shown in several different studies to decrease the mortality of the seriously injured patients, up to 25% from pre-system to after the system's in place and functioning.
So one of the things that we know, and I'm constantly trying to remind listeners that we really want to keep asking the question is, and how do we know that what we're doing is useful, is that I'm assuming that we haven't gotten good enough to decrease the number of accidents or unintentional injuries, but the outcomes of these are improving over time with these systems.
Well, I think in actually Alaska, I think one of the strong points we have here is that we have decreased some of the injuries. And actually that is, you know, really a lot of bang for the buck is injury prevention.
Sure.
And I think that there have been some improvements in our mortality rate from trauma in this state over the last 25 years. And a lot of them have to do with injury prevention. I think we have made some headway, but at the end of the day, we are still left that patients are going to get injured, and we need to have a system in place that trauma is going to happen today, it's going to happen tomorrow, you just need to read the newspaper this morning, and, mm-hmm. and there's a number of patients that were injured, just little blurbs in the paper on. And so we know it's going to happen, so we need to set up systems to take care of those folks.
And I guess just a comment on the prevention aspect, it's almost always better and cheaper to prevent things in healthcare. And, you know, it gets back to car seats and seat belts and National Institute of Occupational Safety Health going out and looking at some of the boating issues and commercial fishing and airplane issues as well. And pediatricians trying to get people to put helmets on when they're biking and all of that. And so you're right. I probably didn't emphasize that there are efforts going on and that there is some success there as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Let me remind our listeners very quickly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you've got questions today about trauma, particularly trauma systems in Alaska or throughout the United States, since we have Dr. Burton on the phone, there are several ways you can get a hold of us to ask your question or make your comments. In Anchorage, 550-8433. That's our number while we're here, 550-8433. We'll be here till just before 3 o'clock today. There's a taped rebroadcast tonight between 8 and 9. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me again until 3 o'clock at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Well, getting all this information to make decisions requires gathering some data, so it sounds like setting up some data collection systems are important as well. Dr. Burton, who does that for the usual trauma systems?
Well, all the hospitals, every hospital has data that they have to turn into the state and data that they look at themselves. So every hospital is used to providing data and collecting data and looking at that data, trying to improve their care. In trauma centers, there's a data registrar that first delineates the segment of patients that they're looking at, the injured patients. And we have codes that we use for that, the injury codes that they're able to pull up through the hospital system, and all these patients that have an injury code, be it a broken finger to a bleed in the head to all sorts of injury codes, they look at all of those and were they admitted, how did they come in, was the hospital standing by and ready for them, were they a trauma alert. So the data registrars are the people that look at that data, process the data, make sure that it's the same and meets the same criteria across the state, and then to put that data report it to the state. And like I say, when we came and visited Alaska and looked at the system they had, you have hospitals reporting trauma data. And that your trauma registry data is there and can be queried for quite some time. So they're already doing the registry piece. It's some of the other things that need to be pulled in to make the whole system work.
The American College of Surgeons, as you mentioned earlier, is an organization that, besides other functions that it's highly involved in that are helping advance surgical care in this country, has gotten involved in evaluating the trauma systems. Is the American College the only organization doing that at this point? And then how do they get invited in to do those evaluations?
The American College of Surgeons has set up the Trauma Center Verification Program. They're the only ones that are really doing the trauma systems throughout the trauma centers throughout the U.S. And that has been in place for many years. And those there's a booklet that lists out all of the requirements for trauma centers and what we call the national recognized standards of trauma care. And then what the American College does is provides site reviewers to go out to the different hospitals then that want to be a trauma center and say, you know, we think we provide advanced trauma center care, and they will go through the whole hospital and how they do trauma care. Are there the correct people standing by on call? Are there the OR standing by and ready? Should they need to be immediately transported to the OR? Do you have ICU ready? And that's that whole readiness of care issue with trauma that is so expensive, because you have all these people standing by ready to work, and they don't, you know, you're paying all those people. So the readiness of care is what gets expensive. However, if your wife is hit in a car and has a severe brain injury, and you're transported to a hospital, you sure hope that there's people standing by and ready to take her immediately to the OR and save her life. But we don't think about that. But the American College of Surgeons basically set these standards, and they modify them frequently depending on data and what is proven to be effective and what maybe doesn't need to be there. It's not as effective, so they continue to modify them to make them the truly national standards of trauma care. And then they send site reviews out to the hospital and look at all of those issues. And then say, here's what your strengths are, here's what some of your weaknesses are, and here's where you don't really meet standards of care, or you met all the standards of care with flying colors. Congratulations, we verify that you have done, that you do what you say you're doing. So the American College of Surgeons is the organization that verifies trauma centers throughout the United States, and then they have now expanded that to say, well, how do all those trauma centers work together, and is there state legislation and things in place that make the whole system work? And that's the trauma systems evaluation.
All right. I'm going to take a short break. Then we have a call that's come in and a couple other issues I want to get into. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1 Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hi, this is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about trauma care and trauma systems, particularly as it pertains to Alaska. My guests are Frank Sacco, the trauma director at the Alaska Native Medical Center and chair of the Alaska Trauma Systems. He's in the office with me, and Reginald Burton, MD, who is a surgeon with the American College of Surgeons and has participated in a review of the Alaska Trauma Systems in November of 2008. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, you can call us at 550-8433, our outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. I think I'll take a caller who's held on through this little short break, and then we'll move on to some questions I have. Jim, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thank you. I experienced a traumatic injury in a car accident with a lot of internal busted pelvic ribs, clavicle sternum separated. But the doctors told me, and they requested me about my lifestyle, they said, had I not taken care of myself, this type of accident kills people. And I was 40 at the time. And I just wonder if there's much effort at educating people about their lifestyles and the damage they do to themselves if they do get in a trauma accident. A lot of that happens in Alaska. And I had hypothermia on top of all that. So survivability, I guess, from a person's lifestyle.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that some of the points you bring up are something that probably Dr. Burton and I deal with, is that the people that get injured are sicker. They have more existing problems, everything from obesity to hypertension. A lot of them are on anticoagulants, and it is harder for them to make it through traumatic injuries. So it is a real concern, and you know, there's lots of reasons to control all of those risk factors that have nothing to do with trauma at all, but that certainly is another one. And as far as other lifestyle changes, I think one thing that we know, and all of us listening and participating today know, that alcohol can be a big factor, a risk factor for traumatic injury. And I think that the American College of Surgeons has actually made it a requirement that we address those issues when patients are admitted. So if patients come in with alcohol-related injuries, it turns out that there's good data that is actually the teachable moment, that people with unsafe drinking, not physically addicted to alcohol, but unsafe drinking behavior, if you know the consequences of it, if you have broken your leg, if you're going to miss work, if you're going to just crash your snow machine and you're going to have to pay for it, that's a time when people are willing to make lifestyle changes. And so we can do actually injury prevention and lifestyle counseling at the time of the injury. So I think that's an important point.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call, Jim. And, you know, before we press on, maybe I'd like to go back and stress the little bit of differences that we do know about Alaskans is injuries are the fifth leading cause of death in all over the United States. But as I look at the notes, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, it's the third leading cause of death for all Alaskans in Alaska, and it's the leading cause of death for all ages in Native Alaskans. Is there some important information in that kind of data that we need to be aware of?
I think that some of the things are kind of intuitive. We know that trauma is a much more deadly disease in rural settings.
Sure.
You know, just because of the limitations of discovery of getting people to the appropriate care. And that's certainly an issue here in Alaska because of the geography. Also, there are other things that play into this, including, you know, alcohol use. And when we count trauma as a leading cause of death, I think that, you know, we tend to split out unintentional injury from intentional injury and from suicide and mm-hmm. homicide, which are often mm-hmm. involved trauma
right.
for the patient ultimately. And when we add those in, it does add up to approaches the same numbers as the number of deaths from cancer. Mm-hmm. I think an interesting thing about trauma, and you alluded to it at the beginning, is that when we look at the years of productive life loss, which is a public health statistic, without getting into any discussions of rationing, mm-hmm. that the years of productive life, which are considered the years before 70, the number of years that are lost through trauma in this state is equal to the number of years lost for cancer and heart disease combined. Mm-hmm. So even though there are more deaths, it's a bias that everything is shifted to a younger age group. And for every death we have from trauma, three people are left with a permanent disability, and that they are unable to go back and live their life the way they were before that accident. So the cost to the community, the cost to the patient and to the family is enormous and ongoing, even when we get away from talking about deaths.
You mentioned you know, that clearly we're a much more rural state than has to be almost any other state. And then you've mentioned hypothermia, which is a confounding variable. But also, I would guess, I don't have the facts in front of me, that we're a much more active state in the sense that we fly more, we snow machine more, we ATV more. I don't know. Are we a society or a culture here that is much more apt because of our activity to increase our risks of injuries and therefore need to be a little bit better prepared for what we're doing?
I think so. I think that you know, it certainly changes the pattern of what we see at the native hospital. I'm unlikely to see as many snow machine and ATV accidents as I do you know, motor vehicle accidents, though we certainly see our share of those. Mm-hmm. So I think that it does definitely change the pattern of what we do. But I think that another thing that you mentioned is that because all of us, even those who live in Alaska, we all go all around the state. We all travel. We all fly. One of the important things may be that whether you survive or die may be who you're with. So if you're hunting or you're out on your snow machine, it may be who's traveling with you and if they know the right thing to do. And that's why we have tried to emphasize in the state kind of what we call first responder care with the development of emergency trauma technician program, where it's a 44-hour course that is actually kind of an enhanced first aid course. And we've actually tried to encourage it to be taught in the high schools, that if you're going to grow up here, if you're going to graduate from high school, and just like you mentioned, the lifestyle we have up here, it's probably good that you know how to do the basic things if somebody gets hurt. Mm-hmm. And I think that I have seen that it has worked in a number of instances, including, I remember a few years ago, we had a patient that had an accidental gunshot wound to an artery in their leg way out in a small village in northwest Alaska. His sister had been trained, and she was able to apply a tourniquet, and the patient was able to get here and have it repaired. And we've seen similar accidents with death that resulted because the basics weren't known.
We remind our listeners again, if you've got questions or comments about our program today where we're talking about the Alaska trauma system and how trauma is handled in Alaska, you can reach us at 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. To respond, you need to be on the phone or emailing before 3 o'clock today. Dr. Burton, you've come up, you've evaluated the Alaska system. Tell us about it. What's unique about it? More importantly, how do we compare? What do we need to do to get better?
Well, I think it was clear to all of us that visited the system there and looked at the Alaska system that Alaska really recognizes the significance of the injury problem, witnessed both by the epidemiological descriptions of fatal and non-fatal injuries and extensive focus on your injury prevention programs across the state, which are exemplary. You have a lot of your epidemiology of trauma and where it's happening and what's going on was fantastic. So but they need to take that and then go, you know, continue with the injury prevention part. Like I say, the bang for the buck is of the injury prevention. And the good parts of it are that, you know, Alaska has identified, you know, what bodies are involved in overseeing the trauma system in the state. However, some of the committees didn't have all the representation of trauma on them to get the clear picture and be able to act on that. So there was different parts that as we looked at it that well, that's why we do the trauma systems evaluation, is to give you a second look and a clear second opinion on how things are done and where we think you could do things better. Some of the legislation needs to occur. Basically, getting the trauma centers to be verified, which means, you know, they stand up to a national standard. I think that there's only one verified level 2 trauma center. That's the Alaska Native Medical Center there. But you know, all of the hospitals that are involved in trauma care should look at becoming verified so that all the standards are met, and not only those, but the ones in the level three trauma centers, the hospitals that have surgeons that are able to assist in the care, but maybe not the neurosurgeons and the orthopedic surgeons, et cetera. But all of those coming into the trauma system, getting verified so that they know what those standards of care are, and the continued education that has to happen in trauma care, because how we take care of injured patients changes quite rapidly in some areas. So establishing that role from leadership from the state on down, and the participation of the hospitals at their level of ability, all of that, and then being pulled together and looking at your data and seeing what needs to happen from there, and continuing to mature the system.
Frank, you'd mentioned that there have been one or two bills that have gone before the legislature. What's the reason for that? What's hoping to be accomplished? What's needed from a legislative standpoint?
Well, the original legislation to try and develop a trauma system up here was passed in 1990, and as many of a lot of activity around the country began as there was national funding to try and encourage states to develop trauma systems.
So basically the federal government back in the 90s said, hey, we need to be encouraging this in some way.
Exactly, and each state, you know, had their own take on how to do this, and some states have gone further than others. Alaska passed legislation that said this is a voluntary thing for the hospitals to do. Mm-hmm. We will designate you as a trauma center if you meet the criteria put forward by the American College of Surgeons. And since we've had that, since 1992, as Reg mentioned, there's really only one hospital that's gotten verified as a level two, which is the highest level for our state, and then four at stabilization or level four facilities. So we really haven't had much movement out of the 24 hospitals. So basically, there was no incentive and there was no disincentive. Mm-hmm. And most hospitals, as Reg said, there can be some complacency about it. A lot of places, there's only one hospital in the town, and they're going to have to take care of trauma. And what does this get us? So there's no incentive, disincentive. What we've tried to do, somebody said, you know, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over and expect a different result. So I think that we've tried to move away from what seemed like an insane process to let's put some incentives in here for the hospitals to do that. Right. And again, this isn't anything that we've made up. This is things that have been done around the rest of the country, and mm-hmm. we've tried to take lessons from other states. But one incentive has been, that there's a lot of uncompensated care. And a lot of that uncompensated care comes through the emergency room and related to trauma. And a lot of birth states, and what we've tried to do is set up an uncompensated trauma care fund where if the care is given at a designated trauma center, that the state would be able to help those trauma centers and physicians that participate offset some of that cost of uncompensated care. And Representative John Coghill in the House and Senator Benny Davis in the Senate have introduced bills. They have the same number in both the House and Senate, 168 and 169, which establish an uncompensated care fund that designated trauma centers would be able to access to help offset some of the costs that Dr. Burton alluded to is that you need to be able to provide that cost. So that
I think it's important, like Dr. Sacco was saying, it's not that they need to be paid more for what they do. But if you are a verified trauma center, that means that you have the national standards, which means you have an OR standing by at any time, day or night, ready for a trauma patient to come in. Well, that costs money. you have a trauma team with a trauma surgeon and the nurses and the x-ray techs and the blood bank and the laboratory and anesthesia and respiratory therapy, and it goes on and on and on. Those people are standing by at a moment's notice, so that within 10 minutes of your call, they're standing there waiting for your loved one to be cared for in the utmost care that is known across and studied across the states to be provided. That costs money to have those people standing around waiting to do that. But when you look at that, it's like, well, you know, that's just too much for us. It's not. When you think that up to 25% of the people that are currently dying with the higher injuries can be saved, you know, that's you're talking about your loved ones. And it's been shown to, it's been proven in many states that the systems do, you know, can decrease the mortality and decrease the loss of functionality that Dr. Sacco also talked about. So it is important. And then understanding that it's not just an accident, it's not a random thing. Like he also said, you know, the American College has made a big impact in making sure that the individuals when they had their crashes and were very intoxicated, that they understand that the intoxication was a very big part of why this might have happened, and if effecting change and letting and having them see that if I hadn't been quite so intoxicated, I might have known that I was going too fast, or I might have seen these things coming. And it's not just an accident, as we love to do, because if you say accident, that means there was nothing you could do about it. When most of these things, when you look, there's a lot of different things that could have happened along the way to prevent it. And that's why, I guess, you know, injury prevention is also a big part of a trauma system. But if you can pay for the injury prevention and never have it happen, wow, that's even, you know, the bigger bang for your buck.
You know, one of the problems you get into, I mean, absolutely correct, and that's what public health has been battling since the beginning of public health, is, you know, if you prevent something, you never know that you've prevented it, so you don't get any positive feedback. I mean, I guess if you're keeping track of numbers, you can see over time that we're improving things, and that's a real help. What are is the Alaska effort? I like the idea of providing an incentive versus a slap on the hand. I keep going back as a pediatrician to parenting. You get a lot more mileage with some positive reinforcement than you do with negative. So that's great to hear. Well, are other states doing similar things? Have we learned our lesson about how to go about in helping to move the process along up here? Or do we need to learn some other tactics as well?
No, I think this is Dr. Burton again. I think the Alaska is following many other states that have found it to be very successful in that you reward the care that has been nationally proven and follow standards, not so much the centers that can't or won't provide that, and it's not the standards are not that difficult to meet. It's just that you have to continue to watch them and make sure that they're being watched and have a performance improvement system to watch those. Because we have proven that those are the standards that improve care and improve outcomes of traumatic injuries.
All right, we're going to take our final break of the day. You're listening to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking about traumatic care, or care of trauma, I should say, in Alaska, and trauma systems as they're being developed. So we will be back in a short second.
You're listening to Line 1 on KSKA Anchorage. Tonight's edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection at 8 p.m. is recorded and is not accepting phone calls. Support for Line 1 comes from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with a wheelchair on the sign. Children given positive attention and experiences during their early years are more likely to become smart, productive members of society. High-quality early education translates into higher graduation rates, better job readiness, and less crime and welfare dependence. So when you support a young child, you're supporting the economy. For more on early learning, visit bestbeginningsalaska.org. Early learning, it's everybody's business. This message comes to you from KSKA and Best Beginnings.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. My guests today are Reginald Burton, MD of the American College of Surgeons. He's joining us by telephone from Lincoln, Nebraska, and in the studio, Dr. Frank Sacco, who is helping develop a trauma system here in Alaska, and he's also the trauma director at the Alaska Native Medical Center. If you've got questions or comments about the program today, you've got about 15 minutes or so to get them done. You can call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. Frank, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the specifics of problems, getting down to the hospital level, so to speak. You know, it's clear to me the hospitals want to do the right thing. Physicians want to do the right thing. What are the problems? You guys have mentioned that we have one level two trauma center, which is probably for the foreseeable future the highest level we're ever going to have, and that's the Native Hospital. And then level four systems I've got listed is Norton Sound, the Yukon Kuskokwim Delta Regional Hospital, Mount Edgecumbe, and Sitka Community Hospital, with Harborview in Seattle being our level one trauma referral center. Doesn't take very long to realize Providence and Alaska Regional aren't on the list. What's the real problems that we get into?
Well, I think that it can be hard to know. I hate to speak for them completely, but I think having talked to people and from the review that was here, I think the hospitals, as you say, want to do the right thing. I think the hospitals, we are lucky to have really fine facilities, and there's a lot of excellent medical community up here. I think that some of the issues for the administrators at the hospitals are, you know, is this an unfunded mandate?
Sure.
As, you know, Dr. Burton has, you know, expressed that there is a cost involved in providing this level of care. And, you know, where does, you know, at the end of the day, we want the best thing for our patients and things, but is that cost, how's that cost going to be borne? So I think that that's a lot of the concern. I think for the physicians, you know, I think, one, there's a reluctance, I think, in general for physicians to be told you need to be here at a certain time or, you know, you need to follow these standards. But realistically, these physicians are all folks that work very hard, do excellent care. But, you know, trauma patients, they tend to have a higher rate of uncompensated care. A lot of times trauma patients come in at off hours, and they may take up a lot of time. Most physicians, as you yourself know, are that in private practice, they have an office full of patients. They have elective cases to do. That the trauma patients, because we know it's going to happen, but it's not scheduled, that it can be very difficult to work into a practice. So trauma is not something that most physicians want to be taken care of. The thing is that if you set up a system, we can meet the community's needs, and we can make it, has been done in many parts of the country, so that it works so that the physicians also can take care of their practices, take care of trauma patients. They're well supported. There has to be some money that goes into the system for the hospitals and for the physicians to try and provide this level of care. But again, this hasn't got anything to do with one hospital or one physician right. being better than another, or, you know, this is the best care. This is setting up systems so that we can optimize care.
To be a level two trauma center, what's the requirements for personnel? Do they have to be in the hospital? Do they have to be within a certain number of minutes from the hospital? Dr. Burton, maybe you can address this for us. I'm trying to get, again, flesh out the ideas of the problems with to meet these specific requirements.
Level 2 trauma center, which we're currently a level 2 trauma center because we don't have a residency, surgery residency and residents in-house. A level 2 trauma center is basically within 15 minutes of the call that there's a trauma patient coming, 80% of the time those physicians need to be standing there ready to take care of those patients. That's probably the biggest one that a lot of the physicians are worried about. And you have to work that out as a hospital and a medical staff so that there is somebody that takes call. Sometimes that's compensated for by the hospital because they know that you can't have your whole clinic that day, that you have to sort of schedule yourself to be free. Because everybody in the clinic doesn't really, if it's your loved one coming in, you'd think everybody would understand that that surgeon's not going to be there and have to cancel on you with no notice. But when you're the one sitting in the waiting room and your surgeon cancels on you, then you get upset. So the surgeons have to work out amongst themselves who's going to be on call and rotate it around so that not everybody is always having to cancel their clinics and how that's going to work. And they have to work with the hospital. The hospital has to understand that that's a big decrease in what the physician normally does and can do during that time. So the availability and is probably one of the biggest ones that scares the physicians. However, I can tell you that when you do the site visits on hospitals, that's usually not the one that's their biggest problem. It's usually making sure the performance improvement program is working that people mostly fall down on.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I would have guessed it would be always the money and the cost issue, but it requires a lot of time and effort and, again, some expense to get these performance systems up and keeping them going.
Well, the hospital also has to have their internal system in place. They need to have usually a nurse coordinator that is looking at all those patients and helping move it together. They have to have their registrar, which sometimes is rolled into some of their other medical records personnel. They have to have a trauma director, and he has to be paid to have some time to look at the system and make an effect change also. So there's infrastructure within the hospital that has to be in place, and everything costs money. But it is very doable, and the systems that do it find out that the care throughout the rest of the system improves so much that it's worth it.
What about the different kinds of surgical subspecialists or intensive care physicians, the different kinds of specialties that need to be involved? What's the criteria there for level 2 centers, let's say?
Well, level 2 centers and level 1 centers are that's basically the same. You basically need to have a neurosurgeon, neurosurgical capabilities for head injuries and spine injuries. You need to have orthopedic specialties available for not just the fractured ankle, but also the huge pelvis fractures and the acetabular or the hip joint fractures. Those are can be very complex, and sometimes you need not just your regular orthopod, you need somebody who's got some extra training and trauma to do those. And sometimes those are shipped off to the level one trauma center because you stabilize everything else and they may be able to be treated later for the fracture part. But the specialists that usually end up being hard to come by on for the level two centers is the neurosurgeons and the advanced orthopedic surgeons. Critical care capabilities are a definite need, either surgical critical care or the pulmonary critical care specialists to help with those patients in the ICUs because these are going to be very sick people.
You had mentioned, Dr. Burton, before we came on the air, that the Harborview, the level one referral or receiving hospital, maybe it's a better way to say, for our neck of the woods, has trauma surgeons that are on the payroll of the university or the hospital. So they are a paid physician. Therefore, they're being compensated for being there, whether they're working or not. Is that true? And is that typical of most level one trauma centers?
I would say most level ones are university trauma centers or university hospitals.
Okay.
And the level twos work that out in different ways. Our trauma center here, pays us a set fee to be on first call, and that's made to offset the time that I have now not seeing all those patients during the day, because I've freed up my day to take care of patients that happen to come in when I have to be there in a minute's notice. So in some facilities, depending on how busy the trauma is, the physicians are able to do that by the medical staff working out a rotational program so that everybody shares the burden. It's worked out usually on a case-by-case basis through the hospital. The American College of Surgeons just verifies that, I don't care how you get to it, but that the patient, trauma patient coming in, has a trauma surgeon and a team standing by ready to take care of them. That's the bottom line.
Let me remind our listeners for the last time that you're listening to Line 1. We're talking about trauma systems and trauma care in Alaska. If you've got questions, we're going to be here for about another 7 or 8 minutes max. So if you've got questions, call 550-8433, 1-888-353-5752 is our toll-free number, and you can email at line1, L-I-N-E, at kska.org. You know, I every time I think about medicine and healthcare in the country now, I think about the fact that we're desperately beginning to evaluate and think about what we've been doing in this country and whether we can do it better. How do we compare with other industrialized countries in their trauma system? This takes us a little bit further abroad, but it puts some more perspective on that. Can either one of you answer that question?
Reg, do you have anything I can?
There are different systems throughout different countries, which physician responds to the trauma patient initially. Is it an anesthesiologist, as it is in Germany and France, or is it the surgeons that respond? It's all done in different ways, so it does make it difficult to compare. The United States has always been well represented, and our numbers are always the best, as the most advanced trauma care. But there's probably many countries that would differ with me on how we came up to those conclusions.
I think that it's clear what Dr. Burton's saying is that the thing that's common to all this is everybody has decided that there needs to be a system to get the outcome. How you can change some of the components of the system and who the physician is that responds, or whether the physician goes out to the patient. But the thing that is common to all of them is that there's a system-wide approach that goes from the scene of the accident all the way through acute care and rehabilitation. And I think those general principles are what really need to guide as you try to make an impact on this.
So that's the key point that you want to keep saying, and it makes a lot of sense to me. It's not how your healthcare system works, in particular, it's how the system works. And each system may have its own assets and liabilities, and you just have to somehow make those things work. But when they work, we get better outcomes.
That's correct.
How does the EMS system fit in to all of this, the emergency medical systems, and particularly in Alaska? Is there some way that the EMS systems know where they're going to take patients at this point if you have a neurosurgical problem? I mean, does that get into some of the politics or the money, or how are those decisions made?
Well, I think that if you look at EMS within the city, I think that actually, Anchorage is not much different than a comparable city in the lower 48. I mean, we have a very sophisticated and excellent, EMS system here in the city with well-trained paramedics. One thing that is inconsistent that is, was pointed out in the review by the College of Surgeons is that we don't have a single criteria for how to activate a trauma response at different hospitals. Each hospital has a different criteria for, what's considered a serious trauma patient. So that's one of the things locally. Around the state is interesting in that, there are obviously patterns of referral, the way patients come for non-traumatic injuries, things that have been developed. But with trauma, one thing you bring up, a head injury in a neurosurgery patient. With a trauma system, it may be that in Alaska, and it is the case, that a patient with a very severe head injury, rather than being flown to a regional hospital where there's no neurosurgeon, would be better coming straight to where there is a neurosurgeon. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the way that the medevac system works in the state is a hub-and-spoke type thing, where the little villages go into kind of a regional area and then from the regional area to Anchorage. And it's interesting, the Level 4 hospitals, especially Norton Sound and YK Delta, have actually recognized that, you know, we can have a pre-plan in place so that somebody who has got a gunshot wound in the village, it might be better from a plane to go from the regional place to the village to straight into Anchorage rather than waste the time of them going back to a place where there isn't any surgical capability. So those are kind of system things that can be developed. The principles are the same everywhere, but each area has its own unique, you know, resource limitations with the kind of planes they have, the range of the planes, personnel, and what the local health system is. But if we had a statewide system, hopefully all of those efficiency things can be worked into the system so that the pre-hospital system integrates with getting patient to the acute care facilities.
You know, we really only have about 2 minutes. This has been another very rapid hour for me, and I like to leave things with an opportunity to say, to sum up what you think is most important. So let me ask both of you all to do that, and if we have a little extra time, I've got another question or two that maybe can give an answer. Dr. Burton, you have any big final thoughts or comments you want us to leave us with?
Well, I think the main thing that you need to consider when you think about this is that what would you want to have happen if this is your kid, if this is your wife that's injured? If you know that you do not have a system in place throughout your state that everybody's treated the same, and you have the system in place with people standing by ready to take care of them, and that if this happened, same injury happened in a different part of the world, that you may or may not survive it differently. Those things need to come into play. And if you tell us, "Mimi, it's my son," money doesn't mean that much to me. I'm going to give everything I've got in order to save my son. And I think those are some of the things you have to think about. You know, money's tight everywhere. But if this means that, and it typically is your younger kids that have the higher trauma injuries, you need to think about that. And having the system in place so that they get the best care is important. And just making sure that people know that you may or may not have that system in place. There's a different trauma system for the Native Alaskans than there is for the rest of the Alaskans.
Okay. Yep. Dr. Sacco?
I think just as a final thing is that if we really want to realize the benefits, if we really want to save lives, that we need an inclusive system. And that means not one hospital does this. That means that everybody participates at the right level. No matter if the patient arrives at my hospital, if the right thing wasn't done at the Level 4 hospital and at the scene and in transport, we're not going to get the outcomes that we need. Same thing. Harborview is a wonderful facility. We're lucky to have association with them. The right thing isn't done every step of the way. It's not going to make a difference. So I think that it's important that as we go forward, that we bring everybody to participate in developing a system, and then we'll see some real positive outcomes.
Well, Dr. Sacco and Dr. Burton, I want to thank you very much for enlightening us and putting this in some perspective for us. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
Next week, we'll be back, and we're going to be talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. What's the effect of alcohol on the developing fetus with Marilyn Pierce-Bolger and Cherie Scott? So tune into your health and learn more Monday, August 31st at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat at 8 p.m. for KSKA and for Line 1. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.